Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. This is Wissam Sharafuddin speaking to you from Dearborn Blog. And on a first episode of a new program called New Live Discussions. The United States frenzy of statuary iconoclasm has taken a turn into the theater of the absurd, knocking down or defacing statues of national founders or heroes, not only displays ignorance of history, but also assaults the principles of Western civilization that allow for racial progress to continue, said Henry Olson in a Washington Post opinion. Another on New York Times said, "I think a statue is a bid for immortality," Thompson, art historian, told the New York Times. "It's a way of solidifying an idea and making it present to other people. So that's what's really at issue here. It's not the statues themselves, but the point of view that they represent. And these are the statues in public places, right? So these are statues claiming that this version of history is the public version of history." The anti-statues movement between reform and absurdity is what we will be discussing live today, and I have the honor to have with me in the virtual studio Dr. Ronald Stockton from the University of Michigan, Dearborn. He's a professor of political science. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And also I have with me from Wayne State University, a doctoral student and a teacher of political science, Ms. Amanda Beyer.
Hi.
Welcome, Amanda.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. We'll start with Dr. Stockton. We want to hear your thoughts about the subject.
Thank you. Wow, I've been thinking about this for a couple of years, literally. I taught a unit on statues once in one of my classes. I think before we look at statues, we have to think about history, which is very complex and contradictory. Nothing is quite as simple as it seems. Likewise, human lives are very complex and contradictory. I'm thinking about, I was just talking to a friend of mine, a German friend of mine, and during the Second World War, the Red Army, the Russian Army, killed 85% of all the German soldiers who died in that war were killed by the Russian Army. So we can say, I think, that the Russians defeated the Germans and ended Nazism. There's no question about that. But after Germany was occupied, the Russian soldiers went on to a rampage of raping. And this is a horrible time in Russian history. It wasn't even clear to people if the war or the occupation was worse. Now, here's what I ask myself. Would it be appropriate to put up a statue to a Russian soldier who played such an amazing role in history? Or would we basically be winking and nodding at mass rapes that occurred? I, for one, would be happy to see a statue of a Russian soldier, because they changed civilization. They changed the history of the world. So I'm okay with that. But at the same time, I don't want to excuse the fact that there were mass rapes multiple times. Women would be raped over and over. It's not as if you just had one, your turn, and then it was someone else's turn. Likewise, human beings are that way. Each of us have things in our lives that we're proud of, where we've made a difference, we've contributed to our society, to our welfare of other people. And other times we have things that are shameful and we wish we could forget. The thing is, John Calvin, the famous Protestant theologian in the 1500s, said the teaching against bearing false witness included simply dwelling upon a negative flaws of an individual and overlooking what they've achieved. These are the contradictions that we face. Now, when we put up a statue, what we're doing is picking something out of that contradiction, out of that mess of humanity and history, and saying, this is important. This is what you should remember. This is what we need to keep in mind. If you put up a statue of a Russian soldier, what you're saying is, honor the courageous Russian soldiers who destroyed Nazism and saved Western civilization. That's worth honoring. So I think of Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee was one of the founders of Washington and Lee University. If there was a statue which showed Robert E. Lee in a business suit holding the charter of the university, I would clap my hands. This is Robert E. Lee making a contribution to society, elevating us through educating children and young people. This is amazing. If you show Robert E. Lee on a horse in full battle gear, this is a man who, if he had been successful in what he wanted, the United States would not exist and the subjection of African Americans would have continued. I don't want to honor that. So suppose someone wants to honor that. It should not be. Here's a question of location. If you really wish the United States didn't exist, and if you really want Black people to be subjected, put up a statue, but don't put it in the city square. Don't put it downtown. This brings us in Dearborn to the question of Mayor Hubbard. Mayor Hubbard is a hero. There's no doubt about it. When he became mayor, the mob was in control in the city. He drove them out. There were places in the city that were in deteriorating condition. He introduced zoning laws. He introduced tot lots so that little kids in little neighborhoods, you have a tiny little mini park that's there right in the middle of your neighborhood. Those are wonderful things. He provided amazing services. I think he's one of the most successful mayors. But at the same time, that man was a hardcore racist. When I first came to this campus, I came in 1973. I think it was the next year. We took a group of students down to meet with him, and I was stunned. Let me just say, I don't have time to tell what actually happened, but let me just say that anything you have heard about Orville Hubbard, it is worse. And so I don't want that man. I don't want that man's statue dominating the city's image. To those inside the city, you might say, well, he picked up the garbage and he maintained the city. Good. But to anyone outside the city, Dearborn is defined by racism. And so I always felt that Hubbard's statue should go into the museum, the historical museum in Dearborn. There should be an exhibit. I didn't want to throw that statue away. I didn't want to get rid of it. I didn't want it in front of City Hall. I didn't want it out front where people could see it, but I wanted it inside. That would have been my first choice. Use it as an educational opportunity to teach our children about racism and how government officials can do bad things. How am I doing on time? I think I've got a little while to go. The question is, what are we honoring? We're picking things and saying, this is what you should remember. Orville Hubbard was a very complex person. This is what you should remember. Robert E. Lee was a complex person. This is what you should remember. The Red Army was very complex. This is what you should remember. If we pick the right thing, I'm totally with it. If we pick the wrong thing, I'm against it. Now, the question is, if we've got a statue which is embarrassing us or representing the wrong thing, what do we do with it? I don't favor smashing those statues. I think those people who smash statues are usually self-righteous, and I don't have much respect for them. I like what happened in Hungary and other places when the Soviet Union fell apart and communism collapsed. All the statues of Marx and Lenin that were in Budapest were taken down and moved to a special place where there's a park now of basically statues of those people. I think that's appropriate. the statues are preserved. Orville Hubbard's statue is now being taken back to his hometown and being put in the graveyard next to his grave. That's fine with me. I think that's fine. It's very appropriate that he be honored in his hometown for the things that he achieved. A problem is that the past, the present, and the future overlap. We would like to believe that all the bad things that Orville Hubbard did are in the past. They are not. If you look at some of the things people say when they're talking about the Hubbard statue, there's a lot of coded Hubbard think that's right in there. They haven't changed much. So we don't want to teach our young children that this is the way Dearborn people think. We want to give them a new image, and we want to try to erase to the extent possible or to pick an image for the city, which is not the one that might have been stuck with us. I think the Germans have one last point, and now I'll turn it over to Amanda. The Germans have an interesting distinction that they draw. They have two kinds of holidays. One is a celebration of something good, and one is a commemoration, a time of reflection on something that is terrible. We should reflect upon slavery. We should not commemorate or praise those people who have who contributed to slavery and made it worse and tried to perpetuate it. The Germans have a national holiday on the day that Auschwitz was liberated. To them, the Russian defeat of the German army and the liberation of Auschwitz is something to celebrate. It's a shameful period in German history. Every German knows that. A few don't. But basically, that's considered a time to be happy. I was just in Germany a couple months ago on the anniversary of the end of the war, and the German Bundestag declared that a day of celebration. They declared that a day of liberation, that the defeat of the German army and the surrender of Germany in that war was a liberation to be honored and celebrated. That is amazing. So I'll throw these ideas out and let Amanda throw some others in.
Thank you, Dr. Amanda.
Thank you. So I wanted to start by pointing out that the title of this discussion presents us with a dichotomy between reform and absurdity, which I understand is a catchy title to pique interest of potential viewers, but I don't think it accurately reflects like the normative and like cultural understanding of the debate as it's being portrayed in the public narrative and popular narratives. If you follow any conservative media, it's called the anti-history movement, which is reflected in the Olson quote, you know, like saying that people who are in favor of removing the statues display ignorance and, you know, it's an assault on Western values. And I think that is not at all what the people who are in favor of removing statues are trying to accomplish. So from my first 4th of July and through like early years of my educational life, I, like most Americans, was indoctrinated with values of our founding fathers. I don't remember the moment when I realized that our founding fathers didn't actually practice all those values. But I know that it was one of those like moral shock moments that sort of caused me to. Sorry, I got distracted by the reading. one of those moral shock moments that caused me to really start to investigate things on my own. And I think that is a really important thing that we haven't been doing a very good job at, especially in our, I have a child, so in our public education systems these days, we don't teach our kids to question things and to want to like learn anything but the narrative that they're given in order to, you know, satisfy their teacher and pass the test, which is a problem. And I think partly that contributes to why people don't want to give up these versions of history that they've been indoctrinated with throughout their lives. Maybe they don't even realize that they're sided and wrong, or not wrong, but you know what I mean. Anyway, for me, the question isn't should we destroy or remove statues? It's how do we democratize public spaces in ways that truly embody our national values and honor inclusive historical narratives without disenfranchising like large portions of our community. National identities are constructed on the strategic forgetting of historical accuracy. Instead, we adopt shorthand collective memories that typically favor the elites or the ruling classes, and the monuments depicting these collective memories privilege their narrative over other the narratives of the creators. Monuments to the Confederacy began appearing during Reconstruction and through the Jim Crow era. They were not erected to tell a faithful historical narrative. Rather, they were an exercise of protest to changes brought about by Reconstruction and shifts in culture. The Latin root for the word monument means to advise, warn, or recall. The purpose of a monument is not to convey neutral historical information. Rather, its intent is to elicit emotions, creating a living memory that will keep its symbolism alive and present in the consciousness of future generations. They express more about the political, emotional moment in which they were created rather than attempting to preserve accurate historical narratives. Ironically, under typical circumstances, people tend not to even notice monuments are in your public spaces. They're essentially permanently inhabiting your like subconscious, and not, you know, you're not really aware that you're experiencing this sided narrative on a daily basis. And even during the creation of Confederate monuments, their champions accepted that the building of monuments in public spaces should receive the support of the public for whom the spaces exist. Public spaces are a natural arena of citizenship. Public life occurs on the basis of open visibility, scrutiny, and concern supporting public interests and citizens' well-being. Public spaces reflect exchanges between individuals and the community. They define who belongs and who doesn't. They are territorial spaces. That they are, in effect, value-loaded political spaces that highlight the tensions between liberty and control. Territorial behavior reifies power and organizes the identities of social interactions between the controlled and the controller. That's as far as I got in preparing my notes beforehand. But I think that the thing that I really believe is that we need to have a way of creating democratically public spaces that embrace what we've claimed our values are, and we need to be able to do this without marginalizing the voices that have already been marginalized.
Thank you, Amanda, for that. So before we go, and I jumped right away into the subject that we had on hand, and I saved a little introduction to the middle, just to save us some of the time that our audience were waiting for us while we resolve some of the technical difficulties. I wanted to say before we start this program is that we first of all acknowledge the racism problem in the United States. And we acknowledge the police brutality. And we acknowledge the latest incidences, among which is the death of Floyd, that was a depiction of that problem of police brutality and perhaps racism. I've just shared a video to our audience of an episode I've had called "I Can't Breathe" that was dedicated to that subject. Now we went beyond that point into the details of the movement. And one of the things that we don't want this movement to happen to it is to be derailed by distractions. And I personally feel that the focusing on removing statues, although this is not a new subject and Confederate statues have been questioned for a very long time, the movement has probably is acting not in a cohesion with its values. And that's what I wanted to talk about today, because it really troubles me also that there is also blind support or defense sometimes, just because we agree with a certain the rights of this movement, the general movement of Black Lives Matter, or of reclaiming public space and reclaiming the narrative and changing, making our public places reflect our real values and the real values of America, especially at times of heightened racial tension, and the White House is not helping with increasing that tension. So while we are trying to do that, we don't want to become blinded with the zeal for accomplishing that to self-criticize. And I wanted to take a moment with academics such as yourselves to actually review and rethink some of the things that we are doing so we can correct. And that's a normal process. We've seen revolutions before, among which is the French Revolution, that you know, the revision of it was very harsh on itself. That people who study the French Revolution know that it has committed a lot of atrocities to France in the name of revolting for its sake. So we learn from history, and you are political historians. Dr. Stockton, do you want to follow up on Amanda's statement before we go to our other speakers?
You're muted.
Just unmute yourself, please. Unmute yourself, doctor, first. Let me see if I can do it. I can do it. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Am I unmuted? Thank you. I didn't hear Amanda say anything I disagreed with. She made a basic point, I think, that putting something in the town square, or whatever the phrase is, the public space that we all share, putting something in there which basically marginalizes some people, that's a pretty painful burden for people to have to bear. And I think that's part of the issue, that which I was at a discussion of this at a conference, and someone said there's a statue, a Confederate statue. This was a person actually from Michigan. And he said, there's a statue of a Confederate in the middle of my town, and everybody walks past it every day and nobody pays the slightest attention. And I thought, you know, you're white. And I suspect if he had been black, he would have paid attention and recognized that. So I think that's where we have to feature in our statues and in our symbols. And it's not just statues, it's symbols. We have to feature those people who elevate society and unite us and bring us together as much as possible. I tell you, based on my age, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Something happened yesterday that I would never have believed. The state of Mississippi voluntarily, by an overwhelming vote, Democrats and Republicans, white and black, the state legislature voted to create a new state flag which did not have the Confederate flag symbol in it. And the governor, Republican and very conservative, said, if you pass this, I will sign it. And 56% of the public in Mississippi is in favor of this change. I never thought I would see such a thing. Now, that's not a statue. It's a symbol. But the state flag is a symbol of the people of the state. And if that symbol excludes large numbers of people, it's a good thing to change it. So that's not denying history. It's not destroying history. It's basically picking out of history those things that unite us rather than those things that divide us.
Thank you, Doctor. I'm just going to take a couple of comments from our audience. Rayana Safa. Hi, Rayana. Thank you for your participation. She says, I agree to the words of Dr. Stock. She says, move the statues to museums or less important locations. And we have also Frank Varner. He says, Confederate Museum would be the best solution. It allows us to remember the past struggles of the nation. Also gives our future generations the opportunity to learn without repeating these mistakes. Now, we'll come back to this issue because I think within that movement of removing statues, we actually have went beyond Confederate statues, and that's the gray area or the danger spot. I think we can agree to Confederate statues that are placed, like Amanda said, for the sake, or Dr. Stockton also described very beautifully about how it can be, you know, the way the statue is built, the purpose of it, the depiction of it, the meaning of it can make a difference also in that decision. But when we come to the statue of George Washington, the Lincoln Memorial, Jefferson, the Forward statue at Madison, Capitol Hill of Wisconsin, Forward statue is a statue that is not of a specific person. It's a woman depicting moving forward, and it was raised by a women's committee at that time in the mid 19th century, and it's a symbol of feminism. It's a symbol of moving forward. It didn't make any sense, and yet there was no condemnation on its destruction. It was brought down to the ground and destroyed. And there was actually a defense of this type of action, and that's the danger of what we're doing. You know, the movement, the totalitarian thinking that we can fall into if we don't re-examine ourselves and correct ourselves and bring more intellectual substance into this discussion. So I want to bring in Dr. Ali Al-Naimi from the University of New York. He's a professor of Arabic languages in the University of New York and a reporter for New York Times previously based in Baghdad. Mr. Al-Naimi is a journalist. He writes today in Al-Rasif magazine. It's a Middle Eastern magazine in Arabic. And he teaches at the university, and he has a lot of political commentary on political issues. Welcome, Dr. Ali.
Thank you, Mr. Usam. Thanks a lot for having me. Actually, it's an interesting debate, and I really enjoyed listening to all these points of views. And I actually agree with all what has been said so far. I strongly believe that we do have a problem here in the U.S., but the issue of monuments and statues is not actually the main cause now. I mean, when we were talking about this whole movement after the killing of George Floyd and the feeling that we have that we need to address the main issue, which is racism, through legislation, through Congress, through reform in the police and, you know, criminal justice system. This is a legal process. This is a media process. But bringing down monuments is not actually, it's such a, at this point, it's not the main issue that we need to focus on. So I think by going, you know, after monuments right now and making it the main issue, this is as sort of a distraction from the main cause. The thing that we need to really focus on is how to bring about a genuine grassroots solution for all these problems. Bringing down monuments is not, and it's not a solution for anything. And we can look at what happened, for instance, in South Africa, and with the Rhodes statue and the whole thing that happened. It didn't really fix anything. The other thing is, I also have a problem with any group. I mean, regardless whether I agree with them, with this group or not, but a group that would put itself in the position of guardian on a whole nation and will decide by itself which monument should stay, which monument should go. This is an issue that needs a national debate, and whether on the level of states or on a national level. And I mean, if Wisconsin decides to remove any statue or just, you know, move it to a museum, put it somewhere else, that's something should be done in a legal, civilized way. It's not up to a group of protesters just to go and deface any statue or bring it down, just like, you know, some people attempted to do in D.C. I don't think it's appropriate for 2020 to see people running around in streets just, you know, doing whatever they want, especially when you're talking about the history and the memory of a nation. As we said, and as your guests, Professor Stockton and Amanda said, this memory of a nation, I mean, there is no pure human experience. I mean, human history is just a trial and error, and we have a lot of mistakes, a lot of actually, you know, crimes happened in history, killings, just name it. I mean, it's human. It's part of history. You cannot go back in history and try to purify it based on your own standards right now. You have to look at it the way it is. You have to study it, understand it. But you cannot just put the whole nation under the sort of a tent of oxygen and say you have to breathe this pure oxygen. It's the fact is Christopher Columbus was the first one who actually led the discovery of North America. Now, was he a saint? Was he a good person? I mean, in history, he was not. He was a murderer. He was a criminal. Just, you know, he committed a lot of atrocities, but he is part of American history. You cannot simply just throw his statue away and say, no, he was a bad person. We should not teach our kids about him. Now, the monuments, are they out there to glorify or just to keep the memory alive? Now, this is also an issue that needs to be debated. I mean, when I put a statue of, let's say, not just the Confederate, I mean, there is a lot of focus on Confederate monuments, but it's just a whole series of events, because where do you draw the line? I mean, in London, for instance, some protesters wanted to bring down the statue of Churchill. Now, I'm from Baghdad, and we have a really bad memory of Winston Churchill. It's a different side of Churchill that we see that the Europeans, of course, don't see, and I understand the controversy here. I mean, Churchill is a war hero. He fought against Nazism, against Hitler. He managed to, let's say, rescue the whole European continent from the danger of fascism and Nazism. But for us, he was the minister of colonies, and he looked at you know, Iraqis, Indians, Africans as, you know, barbarians that should be, you know, treated savagely the way they are. They should be bombed. I mean, it's from British documents, but do I support bringing down his statue because of my own memory of Churchill? And this is where you try to draw the line, because it's always a controversial thing. It's always a relative thing. Now, as I said, it's not up to a certain group to decide which monument should stay, which monument should go. Displaying these monuments, I would say that no one was even paying attention to a lot of them until we had these latest events. A lot of people would just walk by and maybe read the name and, you know, just, you know, Christopher Columbus or whoever, General Lee, or, I mean, there's no General Lee, I think, in New York. But wherever you go, I mean, you see a monument, you read the sign, and you walk by. It should be actually the result of the true reform that we should do. It should not be the first thing that we should do, because bringing down monuments is not gonna change anything about police and the way they deal with racism. It's not gonna change anything that has to do with the criminal justice system. The issue is much deeper than going around and having sort of our own revenge from, you know, statues or monuments. This is an issue for national debate. And I myself, I think that this brings to my memory what happened in the Middle East, when every sort of group that comes to power would simply eliminate what used to happen. To have in the past, like since the time of the pharaohs, where they just used to, you know,
erase the previous history,
erase everything, and, you know, it's the new pharaoh, and then move on. I mean, the statue of Buddha, for instance, and what Taliban did. I know it's much different, but the principle is the same. I mean, where do you draw the line? I mean, for them, Buddha was a symbol of blasphemy. We don't agree with that. We disagree with that. We think that, you know, this is absurd. But for them, it was a cause that's worth actually bombing or destroying the statue. So, and again, if you go to Rome, you see statues of emperors who were actually crazy killers. You know, they had these massacres throughout history, but they resemble just the purpose of they were here. They did that. Let's learn from it.
Dr. Ali, I have a question for you. The destruction of the Saddam monuments in Iraq, some drew a comparison. I saw a meme today criticizing the protesters who are protecting the Theodore Roosevelt statue in front of the Natural History Museum in New York, saying that these are the same people who were cheering the destruction of the monument of Saddam. What's your comment on that?
Well, I mean, I would
And you as an Iraqi, what's your thoughts on the destruction of all the monuments of Saddam after the occupation?
Well, I'm completely aware of Saddam's crimes against not just Iraqi people but against other nations in the region. But again, I have the same feeling. I mean, I would have very much favored that his statues would go to a museum and they would be there for younger generations to see. I mean, look at this man. Look how, you know, look how dictators sort of glorify themselves as a lesson for younger generations, not to go there and glorify someone like Saddam, but you should have this piece of history alive in the memory of your nation. If you bring it down, you're erasing. You're trying to retroactively correct or purify your history, which is something that should not happen. I mean, we should learn our history the way it is. Otherwise, we would simply be photoshopping, if I can put it this way. You're just simply photoshopping your history, and this is not the way you deal with the nation's history.
Thank you, Dr. Ali, Mr. Ali, very much. And we'll take comments from Amanda and Dr. Iran on this. on what you've said. I want to add something to what you said too, that there is an art history, because I, you know, I'm a student of art history. I'm not an expert, but I'm a student of art history. And there is that artistic value in sculptures. Forget about even the subject matter, just in terms of who sculpted, the art of that time. That also has a value in itself, regardless of the topic of the statue. So I'm against destruction completely. The worst case scenario is basically moving or the best thing that you can do is moving it to a museum. But destruction of art is, for me, is one of the very few blasphemous things. Doctor, comments on Mr. Ali's interjection?
No, I like his views. I did have a thought I'll just throw out. I haven't heard anyone else say this, so I'll be the first one. I think in a sense, George Floyd's body was a statue, not in a sense of a statue, but it was a symbol of Black dignity and Black safety. And when he died, I mean, a lot of Black people die. This is not, and a lot of people die innocently. They didn't do anything. George Floyd didn't do anything, but when he died, it was like a symbolic assault on the identity of 30 million people, plus millions of non-African Americans who identified with a better country than the one they saw in that video. And I think we get sort of trapped if we think of a statue as simply being a something that was carved. A human life is also carved. Parents start with a little baby. They teach it how to write. They teach it how to talk and to walk. They teach it how to behave. They teach it how to play basketball. And then it comes back and is destroyed. And so I think there's a lot of symbolism here that George Floyd's death went far more beyond an individual, as we can see. It unleashed a whole nation of sentiments that were just sitting there, and we didn't know how to express them. I mean, my white grandkids are out marching on behalf of George Floyd. And that's something that would not have happened a year ago.
Not only nationally, Doctor, but even internationally, the Black Lives Matters movement have inspired people all over the world to condemn racism. Even in India, I heard today on NPR that India now they're paying attention to mm-hmm. prejudice against skin color. Amanda, your comments on Mr. Ali's comment.
I just wanted to. One thing that I was thinking was that it's important to realize, especially when we're talking about like symbols of Confederacy and symbols of these like massive institutionalized racist systems that we have in place, it addressing them is addressing the issue of the day. They're not separate issues. At least that's how I don't think the people who are protesting see, you know, like ending racism without acknowledging that the Confederacy happened and we're still glorifying it. Like the two need to happen both in order for one to happen. If that makes sense. It's like you can't just ignore, you can't whitewash history and pretend that the Confederacy was okay, or that, you know, we didn't systematically disenfranchise like half of our population for centuries. And it doesn't just go away in this moment of like people on the street and fighting against racism right now. That's like systemic transformation, and these symbols are targets, but they're also important to address, because if the symbols remain and aren't addressed, then how can we really fix the underlying problem?
Thank you, Amanda. Thank you, Mr. Ali. You'll be with us in the studio virtually. If you want to come back in for any comments, please leave me a note and you'll come back in. I want to introduce now Mr. Muhammad Baqir Muhyiddin from Washington, D.C. for his interjection. Tafadhal Baqir.
Hello, everybody. This is an interesting conversation, and I enjoyed listening to all the opinions. Although I agree with a lot that was said, I do disagree humbly with a lot that was said as well, with all respect to the whole panels. I'm not Dr. Ron Stockton or Professor Bayer or Dr. Naimi. I work, right? So I'm not in an academic field, but so I'm going to represent my opinions based off my readings and my limited knowledge. So I recently got through reading Jefferson's Quran. It's a book written by a professor, I believe, out of Columbia, and she released it after Obama was attacked for being Muslim, because being Muslim is not good, right? So the idea of the book pretty much was that America was intended to be white. Thomas Jefferson and many of the other founding fathers, they wanted America to be a nation for white people, regardless of what religion or creed they come from, but it was supposed to be a white nation, right? I like Jefferson a lot. And I don't know why I have a connection with Thomas Jefferson. Maybe it's because I grew up on Jefferson Boulevard in Canada as a kid, or maybe because he owned the Quran. But I like his monument here the most as well in D.C., and I spend a lot of time there. I feel like it's the most secluded, most private. He also had, there's a quote that's written on top of his monument on the walls that says that he compares writing the laws in a way that can adapt to future generations, because if you do not do it that way, then it's as if you're telling your great grandchildren to wear your clothes and they will not fit into them. So he saw the idea that society can evolve and adapt and whatever, and I feel like that's what makes America great. I mean, I'm going to apply for citizenship in a year, right? I'm not a citizen yet, but I feel as American as anybody else. And I've been here for years under visas and undocumented for a while. And I feel like when I do speak, I speak as an American. Although if Uncle Sam is watching, as a North American, right? Just in case. So saying all that, America changed its mind regarding being a white nation. I mean, first they had the 3/5 compromise where a black person or a black man, not even woman, represents 3/5 of a white man. They welcomed Puerto Rico into their nation, but as a territory, because it was not a white territory. So it was not a state. That was after World War I. So it did adapt, it did change, and it changed based off of the opinion of white people. Otherwise, it would not have changed. I mean, I know people in Iraq, Egyptians and Palestinians, that have been there for 2 generations and 3 generations, and they're still Egyptians, and they're still Palestinians. They're not Iraqis. So this nation created a system, these founding fathers, that we can actually become and make it part of our identity, which is something that I really do respect. Regarding statues, public statues, they don't teach history. Like, nobody goes to learn history from public statues. Like when I go visit Italy or any city and I go look at the monuments they have up or whatever, represents the culture, represents the values, represents stuff that they are proud of, right? Removing them does not erase history. When Saddam Hussein's statue was removed in Baghdad, he was not removed from history. We did not change history to skip the three decades of crimes he caused to our families. But, I mean, I was a kid when that happened, and I watched it here, and I was in Dearborn. I watched it at Famous Hamburger. We were watching the news when it happened, right? But when they took down that statue and there was an old woman that was dressed like my mom and she had the sandals in her hand and she was smacking it, right? That took me to tears as a 17-year-old or 16 or 18, however old I was. Just because, I mean, how much did she suffer where she felt the need to go out in front of American tanks, find these foreign troops and just go, you know, go crazy on this one statue? Like, what does she feel? So, I mean, that in itself to me is more of an excuse to get rid of the statue. If it survived the war, then yeah, I put it in a museum. But it didn't, and I believe removing it was more symbolic than keeping it in a museum, especially in this day and age. Like centuries ago, like with the Romans and the Greeks, there was no photographs. You can't take pictures and have digital formats that store them for history, right? Now we have all these pictures and videos and stuff. So, like, what's the big deal? Like, if something does not survive a movement or a war, it's still there. We're still going to see it. We're still going to know about it. So I believe that, like, troubling monuments and statues, all they do by existing in public space is that they empower those that may harbor similar beliefs. So if you have a statue of someone that's might have had trouble in history, right? And let's say you have an African-American kid walking past by with his father. How does his father explain or his mother explain it to him or her? Or if you're a little white kid walking with your parents who may like that part of history, like, yeah, see, America changed, but, you know, our statues are still there or whatever. So it's empowering and degrading at the same time, depending on who's looking at it. The reason why I feel like we're seeing happening what's happening today is because government failed to get involved at the right time. If government does not take actions, the people will take action, right? So in an example of Dr. Ron Stockton's in Europe, when they collected all the statues and they put them in a park, that was probably done before there was protests and people like outrage. That happened right away because they knew that those statues cannot stay there, right? Similarly with the state of Mississippi. Similarly with right here in Virginia, they recently voted to rename Robert E. Lee High School, and they're considering Obama or another name for it. Public leaders, they don't get the privilege of being remembered by their CV, like what's good and what's bad, like for Robert Lee. They usually, like, their last hurrah, how did they leave the game? Like, well, everybody else, if you're an engineer and you have one invention early on in your career and then a bunch of failures for the rest of your life, you're credited for that. You only remember for the one breakthrough that you found out. But Robert Lee, he fought against the United States. He was a general for an army that fought against the United States. So it was, regardless of what he did before that, that's his legacy. I mean, he's not part of what America ended up being. I mean, if they won the war, that's a different story. Then I probably wouldn't be here, right?
Bakr, you've mentioned a lot of good points, and I want to have a chance for Dr. Stockton to comment, and then Amanda. Would you mind just holding on the rest of the points? Okay, thank you very much. Amazing points. Dr. Ron, I know you have a lot of comments on this. Please.
I find these comments very, very valid and very logical. I think something is, I think I want to comment on one thing you said, though, about those statues in the past that got moved. You know what? I think the communist system collapsed. A new leadership came to power that reflected public opinion. They weren't head of public opinion, they were public opinion. I think that's probably true in Mississippi, too, that those people, they're certainly old-style politicians down there. This is one of the most conservative states. But at the same time, I think they can, you know, as people used to say, you don't have to be a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing. And I think those people probably figured out that a holding on to a Confederate flag as a symbol of your state is not the way to go. And I think your point is very valid. When you've got a government which is reflective of the views of the public, they're going to address those issues. And if there's an element in their society that's been marginalized and oppressed, and they don't want that element out there smashing up windows or whatever, they're going to deal with that problem. And so I put on my Facebook today that I'm skeptical about being optimistic because I've been optimistic about racial issues before, and I've always been disappointed. But to see Mississippi, you know that song Nina Simone sang, Mississippi Dam, I'll leave part of it out. It's worth listening to. When you think of that song, and then you think of the legislature overwhelmingly, with the support of a conservative Republican governor, deciding to take down the Confederate flag from off of the state flag, that is a revolutionary development. And I think these people have been watching the news and reading the public opinion polls, which show that the public, white, black, conservative, liberal. They're all sympathetic to these protests. They all think the police have been doing harm. And I think the leadership is beginning to shift in the direction of the public. And thank God for those young people who are out there demonstrating, marching, and making us think about things that we probably wouldn't have thought about if they hadn't been out there demonstrating and marching. And thank God for my white granddaughters who are out there marching with them.
Thank you, Doctor. Bakr, would you be disappointed if they attack that Jefferson monument that you like to sit next to?
Oh, this is so sensitive. Okay, let's think about Jefferson. He was a slaveholder.
I adapt very easily to whatever environment.
Yeah.
So if Jefferson's gone, I'll find someplace else to go.
Yes, Dr. Stockton. Jeff, what's your thoughts on Jefferson?
Well, you know what? I've got a view on Jefferson. Jefferson's one of my heroes because I recognize all of his flaws. Nobody can deny them. When I lecture on Jefferson, I mention every one of those flaws so that there's no confusion about exactly what we're talking about. But what Jefferson did was give us the most electrifying words in American English. All men are created equal and are endowed by their creators with inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Abraham Lincoln said, if it were not for those words, America would not be America. He said that is the essence of American identity. What Jefferson did was give us a vision of a country that he knew was out there somewhere. He was never able to implement it in his own life, in his own time, in his own society, but it's like throwing a message in a bottle and somebody else is going to find it and do something good with it. So I think Jefferson deserves his monument in Washington, D.C. And I'd like Amanda to respond to that.
I like Jefferson.
Yeah, you love it. Okay, we're on the same side, Amanda.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the idea that those are the values that like inform the development, the perpetual development of American identity. And I do think in response to like the vandalism and the tearing down of statues or symbols, I do think that a lot of that comes from like this frustration where, you know, there's not a venue to appropriately like get that message out anymore. There's not a way for the young people to engage in like civilized discourse. And once you're like so far removed from having the opportunity to engage meaningfully with your surroundings, you take action in the way that you can, in the way that presents itself. And if they hadn't been doing these things, if the, you know, protests hadn't been going on, if statues hadn't toppled, if there wasn't these kinds of like shocking things happening to some people, would the state of Mississippi have changed their flag? I don't really think so. I think that like the people in the streets have like done incredible things in pushing American values as Thomas Jefferson envisioned forward.
Yeah, but it's a slippery slope, Amanda, also. We have to be careful. Like in France, when they went to de-Christianize the nation, and France is, Paris is a museum. The whole city is a museum. And they went to every single symbol, to every single cross, and they broke, to every single sculpture, and they changed. It's a major deformation of art that wasn't really necessary to make that point. And it cost France a lot because later on, you know what happened. And Robespierre created his own religion. But and also what's happening, like all of us, and this is the issue I have all the time, is that I discuss with people and everything they say is rational. And we all agree with, we all hear an agreement on everything that we've said. But then you go to the streets, and then they want to bring down the Lincoln Memorial or George Washington. There is this idea, and I don't know where it comes from. Maybe lack of history in schooling, or lack of, or maybe because we don't have a lot of art history in the streets. We don't have a lot of statues like in Europe. Like in Europe, the idea of taking down a statue because they were a slave owner is ridiculous, because most of the statues are of Caesars and kings and the slave owners, and that was the nature of the world 200 years ago and before that. So the idea of idealism is that they want to, for example, one person suggested to take down the Roosevelt monument in front of the Natural History Museum, which is, according to the I read the purpose of the sculpture, the notes of the sculptor himself, it's a monument that was made to glorify Africa. It has nothing to do with African Americans. This is about Africa. It's a fighter from a hero from New Guinea or Uganda or something, a fighter is symbolizing Africa, and an Indian symbolizing the Native Indians as a guide and as parts of the progress of civilization, of the dependence of Western civilization on these on the previous civilizations and on the indigenous civilizations. It's a positive message, but anyway, I don't want to dwell into that. But he suggested removing that and putting a sculpture of Robert De Niro. But guess what? With the today's standard that we have, in a few years, Robert De Niro also will have something in his closet that will not meet the standards of being an ideal person to be in public. And guess what? There's no ideal person to be in public, but monuments are there to mark history and to. So I just wanted to add that, so it's not so to pinpoint some of the things that are going on that we probably don't agree with. Anyone can comment on this before we bring the last guest. We're out of time. Yes,
I was going to say I think it's a failure of the government. Like if people's voices are not heard with their government, they go to the streets. As what you described in France, it was a revolution because government failed. And same thing over here. We do not have a president that is uniting the country in these troubling times, and the youth want to be heard, but there or the riot, say protesters, whatever you want to call them, they want to be heard, but there's no way for them to be heard. You're going to see them doing a lot of ridiculous stuff, but I don't think it's their fault. It's human nature. But that pinpoints the, like, you know, the buck stops at the top, is the expression goes. Like if you have it's a problem at the top, it's going to come down all the way to the bottom. So that's why it's very important to have good leadership.
And with, like, the cause of fighting institutional racism, it's not just right now their voices aren't being heard. It's like generations upon generations upon generations of voices that have been ignored. And so I there's a lot of trying to make progress and just being like shut down. So I think that people are going to have irrational reactions in situations where they're not being rationally listened to.
Thank you, Amanda. Baqir, thank you. We have a final guest with us. By the way, I invited a lot of people who had various a spectrum of opinions. I wanted to make this discussion as rich as possible. Suhan D'Souza is a graduate student in MIT and Cambridge. Suhan, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks Go for ahead. Inviting me.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thanks. My pleasure. So a lot has already been discussed so far, covering many points that I was going to address also. I guess probably the way I could add to the discussion is talking about maybe where the discussion shouldn't go, like an appeal to consequences or, that the fact is that in a society, in pretty much any complex society until a couple of centuries ago, or in some cases decades ago, slavery was pretty much the rule, right? Chief Seattle, after whom Seattle is named, for example, he owns slaves, and he has busts of him and statues of him are in Seattle. The city of Seattle is named after him. And then, you know, you have pretty much everywhere, East Asia, South Asia, including the caste system, ostensibly, and the Middle East, North Africa, the Corsairs, famous for enslaving all along the European coast. So it's like to hold the standard at let's not have any statues of slave owners is kind of unrealistic, and it also depends on what we're honoring them for. There are many, for example, some cultures where people are deified for certain aspects of their character, even though they may be lacking in other aspects. In Chinese culture, for example, you know, you have a god of this and that, and they're usually people who have been deified, but they may have had character flaws. At the same time, they represent something that they are achievers in and that they were models for. And that's why they are remembered. In the case of Confederate officers and generals and leaders of the Confederacy, they are known for specifically like going against the tide of history, like going against progress. They're pushing against the abolitionist movement, pushing against the march of progress. So that's effectively what they're known for, right? But in the case of many other statues, and not just leaving out the, I'm not just talking about like outliers like Matthias Baldwin or, you know, Robert the Bruce and such, who are vandalized, Garantis vandalized for nothing at all, but you know, statues of Grant or Washington or Jefferson. These were people who generally went along with the march of history and pushed it forward, and imperfectly so. Of course, like personally, you know, I would probably take a very extreme view that government speech itself should be done away with, and statues definitely count as government speech. That's my general outlook on this whole thing. But while government speech exists, we should try and have a coherent and consistent policy where we look at history and we look at the lessons we can learn from people who helped found the best of what the country, the best ideals of what the country was founded on, even if imperfectly so. That would include Washington, includes Chief Seattle, include Jefferson. So that's the position I was coming from.
Thank you. Thank you, Suhan. Any comments, Dr. Ron or Amanda?
I just had a thought. In the year 2000, I wrote what I call a Millennium Journal. Every night, after my wife would go to bed, I would go in and write down everything that happened during the day, and I would comment on the events of the day. And I wrote an introduction to that. It was called, it was directed to my descendants in the year 2100. And I said, there's going to be a lot of things you're going to read where I was obviously blind to some important issue, or I had values which in retrospect look bizarre and strange and not honorable. And I said, just enjoy yourself. I'm doing the best I can in this life that I have. And those of you in the future are going to look back and see me as an anachronism of an earlier age where I just didn't get it. And I said, that's fine, because that's what happens in life. History moves on and the rest of us are left behind, because we were doing the best we could in the age in which we existed.
Thank you, Ron. Amanda?
I don't really have anything more to add. I mean, I do sort of think about like ways in which you know, like, Todd, you hit upon the idea of like a cohesive national policy, and I don't really know that that is, I don't know that that's like necessarily would work. I think it needs to be more like, I feel like communities themselves need to be engaged in deciding what their spaces look like. And I like, you know, there's this method in urban planning called the design charrettes, where you like bring in members of the community and you discuss and you collectively design the space you want to reinvent. And I think it would be really interesting to have some, you know, like design charrettes around like public spaces and new memorials, new monuments.
Speaking of which,
localization of it could also be a consistent thing, as long as it's, you know, applied to everyone, not just some places and not others.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, Rihanna Safa, she says we can also keep the statues in place, but put a red mark on it saying it won't happen again. So it will be as controversial statues that stay there to learn from. Frank Varner says it's time to archive these monuments of hate in museums. We need to start displaying modern day heroes and those things that bring people together in this melting pot, not separation. Also, Rihanna, and she's a teacher, she comments, teachers are responsible to teach controversial issues about all the statues' personalities, positive and negative, so when they visit the monuments, they won't be intimidated or empowered. And we have a question from Muhammad Shirri. He says, my question to your guest is whether they feel optimistic about the future of the nation, given that many are writing as if it is apocalypse. So I will bring in the rest of our guests, Mr. Naimi and Mr. Baqir, and we'll comment all on this before we end the program. And thank you for your patience. We'll start with Dr. Stockton.
Based on the fact that Mississippi apparently has gotten religion, I'm reasonably more optimistic than I was 48 hours ago. But I've been disappointed so many times that I'm not expecting massive transformations.
Thank you. Amanda?
I reserve the right to comment until after November.
Okay. It might happen earlier even, according to what they're saying. Mr. Naimi, final comment and answer to Mr. Shuri's question about optimism. Let me unmute you.
Yes. Yes, I'm optimistic, cautiously optimistic. I don't think we're going to witness huge changes soon, but it's actually a gradual process, so it's going to take some time. But I think it has reached a point where DC cannot actually ignore it anymore, especially we are in an election year. So I think things will be taken seriously.
There is a point that you mentioned, Mr. Naim, and nobody commented on, so I want to put a spotlight on it, is that a lot of these actions are unilateral. You know, when 50 people, for example, go to a statue and they want to bring it down, I mean, this statue was voted on by a city council that has been elected by the whole city. So I feel it's also kind of an attack on democracy, since these are not something that Saddam has put there. This is something that the people have placed there. So, and what Amanda said, that people sometimes feel like, especially the young, they feel powerless, and that's like the last thing they resort to. Maybe we need to educate more on public civil action. Like this, I mentor student governments in a district, and I teach them how to try to amend laws through the city council. And it's something that they're completely unaware of. So maybe we need to teach more on how the, you know, activism can happen through the system. I know it's not as exciting as taking down a monument, and it's slow and bureaucratic. But at the end, you know, maybe we can make that popular. Maybe we can.
Okay. But it's less dangerous than taking the law into your own hands. I mean, changing things the way you want. It's actually a serious precedent to sort of have in the streets and say this is the new generation and what they want to do. It's understood that the way they're frustrated, I completely understand that. I teach students and I'm in constant contact with them and I know. But again, we should have a process. It shouldn't be just like 100 people just decide to take down this statue and go and do it.
Yeah, and I worry about that because we came from countries that, me and you, we came from countries that have been destroyed by these kind of action. And I don't want to, what I mean is by the actions that are unilateral or by anger or by the moment of emotions. And I feel safe within a democratic system, a system that respects law and there is a way for changing things. So it strikes fear in me when I see, you know, that fall down, because you know this is something that we have experienced as well. Yes, Amanda.
I think that the vast difference between like your experience and like the creation of the United States. So it's like we were created out of like these sort of political actions, and we, you know, it's like such a huge part of our history, and we wouldn't be us if we didn't do those things.
Thank you. That's a very important point. We are a nation that started with the revolution and defiance and throwing the tea into the lake. Any comment on that, Dr. Stockton?
I think that's right. At the same time, we have a strong regime. Saddam looked strong, but he wasn't. I was in Syria during the time of President Assad, Hafez al-Assad. You go into any government office, there were at least 15 photographs of Assad on every wall, on every cabinet, whatever it was. This looked like enormous strength. In fact, it was fear. That regime knew that they had no legitimacy. This is a legitimate country. Our regime is legitimate. Right now, we're mad. Many of us are mad at Amanda and I are mad at our president. But the fact is, we're mad at him as a person. We want the government to function, and we believe it's capable of functioning, and it's not functioning. And so I think that's very different from a place where basically you have a regime of fear and terror that's maintaining itself in power by brutality. So I think that's different. When you see a group of people attacking a statue, those really are 50 people attacking a statue. There's no broad support at all for tearing down Abraham Lincoln's statue or many of these other statues. Those are just individuals doing that. And they just happened to get away with it because there were no police nearby or for whatever reason. But I think the stability of the system is very certain.
Thank you. Baqir, final word?
Yeah, so to reiterate what I guess Amanda and Dr. Stockton said, America was created to protect the population from the government, the right to bear arms, the right to form a militia. They don't trust their government. That's the ethos of the country, right? And power is within the people. So if government does not cooperate, people will take charge. Now, to answer Mohammed's question, and kind of related to this question, I do feel good about America, regardless of what happens in November. It's on a positive trajectory. Read the history 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 100 years ago, where America has taken strides compared to other nations just because these topics are discussed and people acknowledge them. I don't see a civil war coming to America. I don't see people bearing arms and fighting the government or fighting each other. So I feel like we'll be good. We're heading in the right path.
Thank you. Sohan, final word?
My final word would be just bringing up that it's probably for the better that many of these changes have happened. You know, like Aunt Jemima branding, or you know, certain media, for example, have been taken down or changed, and certain statues definitely deserve to go. But I think, like, especially now when things are at the hottest, it's more important than ever to say, like, when you see something that is kind of going over the limit or is kind of crossing a line, to say that, yeah, we should probably cool it now than later, because, you know, all this piles into the Team Trump's propaganda folders for their, you know, their ads towards the rest of the election season. So yeah, I just wish, like, there'd be more strategic thinking about this. Reasonable demands can be made, of course, and ultimately, even with peaceful protest, there has to be an underlying threat, ultimately, of, like, eventually, like, if peaceful protest doesn't work for reasonable demands, then there'll be some violence at some point. But it's to remain focused on having reasonable demands and seeing those through. So I think, like, for example, Mississippi's flag, for example, was a great example of, you know, that's something that really should have happened a long time ago, and thank goodness it happened.
Thank you, Sohan. By the way, in a recent survey by Quinnipiac University poll survey, they found that 52% of voters say they support removing Confederate statues, while 44% opposed removing them. With that, we have gone about 20 minutes over time. I want to thank our guests very much. Thank you for your patience with the technical difficulties in the beginning. Thank you for participating in a very rich discussion, enriching it with your opinions and input. Thank you, our audience, for your participation and listening. This video will be available on Facebook and YouTube on Dearborn Blog, also on podcast by Dearborn Blog on Spotify, iTunes, and Stitcher. And see you in next episodes. Have a great night. Thank you very much.
Bye. Thank you.